we got next. This is Free Association with Dave Zarum and J.D. Bunkus.
Welcome to Free Association, a special holiday taping. We tape this. This is you're listening to this in the future.
What's going on, JD?
It's the future.
Okay, what day is it?
This will be released on the 29th.
Hey, what did I get for Christmas?
I didn't get you sh-. I got you coal. Straight up.
Well, I wish I could say I expected otherwise. But I expected coal. That's okay. Coal it is. But I got some...
Coal it is. Hey, fuel. Coal's underrated. Like, it could be a lot worse. Like, dust. I would rather coal than dust. Coal has value.
That's right. It'll work. You know what? Given that I own a railroad line
and
a train, perfect.
And thanks, a train. Buddy. You'd it's have to own really, a train if you own a railroad.
No, in retrospect, that's a really thoughtful gift. And
you're welcome.
My sweet future self appreciates it. I'm just confused about this whole timeline. It's the future. It's the present. Either way, we got a cool show for you today because we're going to be talking about hoop documentaries.
That we are.
One of my favorite things in the world is a good documentary. Sports documentaries kill it always. They just lend themselves to the format so well. And within that, there are so many great basketball documentaries that we just thought this time of year, I'm sure you're getting DVDs for your holiday presents. I'm sure
no, because it's we didn't go back in time. It's the future. It's 2015 still.
Oh,
no, I'm not getting DVDs for Christmas. Dave, don't get people DVDs for Christmas. Don't be like, hey, I got you a Family Guy season 2 box set for $13.99. It was a great deal.
Well, it's way too late. I legitimately got more than one person a DVD.
Download a documentary, pay for it if you can, and put it on a USB key.
So the great thing is, all these documentaries are on YouTube now, Netflix. They all got great hoop documentaries. Later on in the show, we are going to talk to Jason Reed, who directed one of the hoop documentaries you can find on the internet.
Maybe I love it because it's about the Sonics, but it crushes me and I'm not even going
to
lie.
Yeah, no, it's
I cried during that documentary.
It's tough
truly
to watch.
Cried.
It's
bald.
Tough to watch. And I spoke to Jason, who directed Sonics Gate is the film. And it is a sad watch. And, you know, we talked about how it's basically not a feel-good movie whatsoever. Unlike many of these basketball documentaries, you know, they usually end on a positive
note. I actually want to leave
note
now.
Of redemption.
I couldn't even do the interview. I didn't want to talk about
it. I know.
It.
It's obviously super close to home for you.
Jason's a much stronger man than I am. I didn't want to talk about Clay Bennett. I have nothing to say about him. I shouldn't have even said his name.
So let's do this.
Bleep that.
And I think we're going to have a little like best of the show coming up later. But I want to, let's do this. We'll break down. I want to know what your favorite basketball documentaries are.
Yep.
And why. I'll share some of mine. Then we'll talk to Jason. And then I want you to give me the one documentary that hasn't been made yet that needs to be made. I got a candidate. I hope you have one too. Let's do this right after this. All right. Welcome back to Free Association. Like I said, all about basketball documentaries today. There are so many good ones out there. It's hard to really start, but when you're having this conversation, the one starting point clearly needs to be Hoop Dreams. Widely considered, not just the best basketball documentary, but the best sports documentary out there.
I'd have a tough time debating it. I mean, it's all encompassing. It's an amazing, amazing documentary. If you haven't seen it before, it's one of my favorites, but it's not my personal favorite. Is it yours?
You know, I've seen it so many times, and I've interviewed the director Steve James, and also the some of the people who were in the documentary,
Arthur Agee.
Yeah, and it's just so. I'm gonna have to say it's my favorite. Like, I know it's a cop out, but it's just so well done. And you know, I think my favorite part about Hoop Dreams is that neither Arthur Agee or William Gates became anything in terms of players.
Oh, I think that's totally integral to the entire thing. You look at even the beginning of the film where. But they're hyping them up. I think it's Arthur Agee's dad who's like, oh, I know he's going to make it. We're not even, yeah, he's just all over it. In terms of, he's even saying, I could have made it professionally myself. And it's just, it goes to the narrative of just how so many people put so much stock into this and how difficult the dream and how difficult it is to actually accomplish.
Exactly. But even when that documentary came out, I mean, like the book hadn't been closed on those guys as even pro basketball players or whatever. So it just, it's kind of all that more like, it just kind of hits home a little more. It's a little deeper knowing that it didn't turn out for these guys after all of this, as from a basketball standpoint, it didn't really work out for either of the main characters. But, you know, there's different kinds of documentaries, and this is one that's clearly like an embedded film. It's one where the director kind of goes along with the subjects, follows things as they happen. And those are my favorite kind of documentaries because you can't plan for those ones. You know, the most powerful scene in Hoop Dreams, for my money, is when Arthur is playing one-on-one with his dad.
Yeah.
And they're out in the park, and his dad has to kind of time out. He has to go walk away and score some drugs. Like, and they capture this all on camera. They capture the son seeing his dad go around the corner to buy, it was crack, and come back. And it's just so powerful. And you couldn't write that kind of stuff. And it's just, you have to be there with the camera on. And that's kind of the beauty of the documentary, is it's a real-time film kind of unfolding before your eyes, using stuff that your imagination couldn't come up with. You know, there's some other ones I really like, though. Like, there's other kinds that are straight, like profiles.
Yep.
Like, did you see the Doctor?
I've never seen that, no.
I highly recommend it. It's cool. But that's kind of a little more traditional. Like, they just look at a guy. They go through his career. In that case, it was Dr. J. And
what?
Yeah.
The Doctor was about Dr. J, the basketball movie?
It's about Dr.
I thought for sure it was on Charles Barkley.
Yeah, no, Dr. J, Dr. Jack Kevorkian.
Oh, that's okay. That makes a lot more sense.
No, but it's and the cool part about ones like that are you get to use the archival footage. And that's something that Hoop Dreams can't really do. So in The Doctor, you see him playing in Rucker Park. You see him playing in those Harlem games, this footage that had never been seen before. And that to me is the kind of differentiating stuff when you start ranking them and whatnot.
See, for me, when it comes to sports docs, and this is why I really loved recently what a lot of the 30 for 30s have been. I love when they're able to tie in history and tie in sport and show how sport has a stamp on time.
Right.
And
right.
Basketball has a stamp on time. And right. And so for me, for my money, the basketball documentary that moved me the most it's not even so much that it's about basketball. You're not watching about a basketball team. It's not about Dr. J's involved, but it was once Brothers. The story of Vlade Divac and Drazen Petrovic and the fallout that they had upon the breakup of the Yugoslavian national team.
Yeah.
And like the scenes where Vlade Divac goes back and he's still not accepted in Croatia.
Right, right.
And where people are still looking at him and still cursing him out and calling him names over 20 years later was still one of the most powerful things. And him meeting Drazen's mom and talking to her about it and learning, getting a greater appreciation of that team. And so, like, I didn't watch that team. I didn't know anything about that team. I knew vaguely where Vlade Divac came from. I knew vaguely about Drazen Petrovic. I don't have a deep knowledge base when it comes to these guys. Same kind of things where I loved Benji. Benji was a phenomenal one.
Benji
Without
was great.
Bias was a phenomenal one. These are guys who I didn't know of before their documentaries.
Yeah.
And they really are able to place a greater meaning and kind of the fallout and the creation of more that's come out of these stories.
Well,
just
and
the
also,
way that, yeah, like bias affected cocaine use for
well,
basketball
exactly.
players.
The
like,
cool thing about all these is that they start off about basketball, but
right.
none of them are about basketball.
And it's about so much more. And that's those are usually the ones that get me. I do love others. Like, I thought that ESPN did a great job with the Fab Five documentary was really entertaining. The Bad Boys documentary was really entertaining.
Yeah.
I love watching these, but I tend to gravitate a little bit more to ones where basketball is more of the setting
the backdrop,
in a larger
yeah.
context.
Right, yeah.
And we had on the other Dream Teams doc, the filmmaker who made the other Dream Team. That's another one where it's like that, where I like being moved, where sport is used to move you a little bit more. That's always something... To teach you a little bit more about history, sports is used as kind of a facilitator for that, as a vehicle for learning. I love those docs.
Yeah, and that's a great point. Those are the best ones. I mean, the ones that are a little more straightforward, if they're done well, they could be great. Like comes to mind is, I don't know if you ever saw The Year of Yao.
Yeah, it was a good one.
It's a cool one. It's exactly what it is. It's a year in the life of Yao as he goes to the NBA. It's nothing more than that. I guess a little bit you get to the pop culture aspect and the crossover with the Chinese market and whatnot. But really, it's just about this.
It's about Yao Ming.
It's about Yao Ming.
Yeah, and those are fine. And every once in a while, you know, I'll turn on something that's like those. They do even still do the ESPN, like, short docs, the half-hour ones.
Right.
Be just on Shaquille O'Neal or whatever. And it's like, okay, this is great. I love reminiscing and going back in the past and remembering what it was like to be a kid watching Shaq play for Orlando and how I felt devastated when he left and signed with the Lakers, and I couldn't stand it. And remembering, like, sometimes I'd even forgot that, you know, watching some of that stuff, that the Lakers struggled in the first couple of years of Shaq. It wasn't just like immediate success. Like, they needed Phil Jackson to get over the hump. Like, it's fun having that process. But ultimately, for me, when I'm really sitting down and I'm really getting invested in something, it's got to be a little bit more. And that's what those ones have done. And Once Brothers, again, maybe I'm kind of a baby. I'm referencing a lot of times I've been brought to tears. But Once Brothers was another one that got me choked up. Hoopstreams did too, though. So,
but that's the beauty of this kind of stuff. Like, I'm not a big
crier. I'm a crybaby.
I'm not a big crier, but, like, it's not because I don't want to. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a big crier because movies don't really do it for me most of the time. But when you have a good documentary, when it's real, you know, that kind of real emotion, you can't replicate that.
The only fictional movie I think I ever cried in was Walk to Remember with Mandy Moore, which is an excellent film.
Well, I cried in bed.
Whatever happened to Shane, whatever his last name is, that was in
just
that
for movie. The record, this is the second time on Free Association that you've told us that you cried at A Walk to Remember.
Yeah. It was tough. I watched it with my mom, okay? It was intense. He made her the telescope.
I cried when the dogs were fighting in Babe. Seriously.
That's pretty good.
That's what gets me.
Yeah. That was a tough one.
I don't want to see the dogs fighting with
each other. No, no one does.
They should be getting along.
No, they don't.
But yeah, and the other cool part, you're right. It's like when documentaries can step out of the sports arena and address bigger issues, it always makes them that much more powerful. But the other thing I do like about a good basketball documentary is when, I mentioned with the Harlem, the Rucker Park stuff with Dr. Dre, is when they can show you stuff that you've kind of heard about a little bit, but you've never really seen
never
it.
Never had a piece of, right.
And the best example of that I can find is the Dream Team documentary that the NBA TV produced.
Yeah, that was an excellent film.
When they had the clips of them, the practice, the infamous practice.
Oh, see, for me, my still favorite part of that doc is John Stockton getting off the bus.
Yeah, that's good.
There's nothing that will top that from that documentary. John Stockton getting off the bus and talking to people wearing shirts
with his face on it.
No one recognizes and having
him.
No clue who he was. That was incredible.
But it's a great use of, like, archival footage. And we're going to talk to, I'm going to talk to Jason Reed from Sonicsgate, in a minute, and one of the cool things about that one is their use of kind of the archival footage to really hammer home what the team meant to the city and whatnot. You want to go to it right now? You want to go?
Yeah,
to
let's let the audience hear it, and I'll step out of the room and cry, and then come back.
All right, so let's do it now on Free Association.
When the wind blows and the rain feels cold, with a head full of snow, with a head full of snow.
My name is Jordan Kilganis. I'm a 6'1 professional dunker, and you're listening to Free Association.
The sound of strangers sending nothing to my mind. Just another mad, mad day on the road. I'm just living.
All right, welcome back to Free Association. You know, we've been talking about sports documentaries all show, basketball documentaries specifically, and one that that is definitely close to its director's heart is Sonicsgate, Requiem for a Dream. You know, this is a really, really well-done documentary looking at the move from the Sonics from Seattle to Oklahoma City. It's pretty heartbreaking for the most part when you you have such kind of invested subjects being interviewed in the story. But the director is Jason Reed, and he joins us right now. What's going on, Jason?
Hey, what's going on? Thanks for having me.
No problem. So I got to ask you right off the bat, I mean, when did you see a documentary in this story? I mean, you have, like, classic villains like Clay Bennett. Stern comes off like a pretty villainous in this as well. You kind of got all the tropes there, but at what point did you get involved and think, you know, I can make a documentary out of this story?
Well, I think I got involved just shooting what was happening about 6 months before the team left, or maybe about 9 months. You know, the first thing I actually ever made was Major League 4, and it was like a spoof on it with, you know, different villains, roles cast for the different villains and stuff. But I made some short videos for the Seattle Weekly, the local newspaper, you know, alternative newspaper here, and shot the rallies and went to the trial and stuff. But I wasn't totally thinking feature doc, because at that point I was thinking we're going to save the team, and I'm just making videos to help save the team so they don't go away. And then, of course, the team left, as is detailed in our film. And it was probably, you know, a few months after that, it really stung the first couple of months. And then myself and the executive producer, Colin Baxter, just decided, hey, you know, let's go ahead and do this thing. And it was within about 6 months of that, we were actually out shooting interviews and putting the film together, and we released it a little bit over a year after the team left, immediately for free online, just to get the word out as to, you know, why, you know, how horrible it was and the way the team was stolen from Seattle.
So did you grow up in Seattle?
Yeah, born and raised in Seattle, so I was a lifelong Sonics fan. You know, I was a senior in high school when they were in the NBA Finals against the Bulls in 96. And, yeah, it's just, if you would have asked me the one thing I wouldn't want to lose from my city, I probably would have said the Sonics, you know, even before, like, the Space Needle or something like that, you know? So.
And that's like a theme throughout. I mean, that's something that's echoed by just about everybody in Seattle who you interviewed for this thing.
Yeah,
I mean, you guys did a great job of kind of showing just how important the team was to the city and the guys growing up there. You know, you mentioned the interviews, and one of the cool things that stuck out to me was just the broad range of guys who you got to speak for this documentary. I mean, you have you have Seattle players like Jamal Crawford and Brent Barry, Nick Collison's in it, but then you also have guys like Jeff Ament from Pearl Jam, Sherman Alexie, the writer poet. I mean, it's a pretty broad range. What was it like trying to get guys involved? Was it easy or a bit of a struggle?
You know, at the beginning, it was definitely a struggle, you know, not getting calls back from, you know, like Peyton's people, for instance. But, yeah. You know, once we dropped the trailer, all of a sudden we got Sherman, we got Peyton, you know, we even got Wally Walker, who you know, right. was a part of the ownership group at every phase of this thing. And, you know, it was kind of a snowball effect. So we started off thinking, okay, we'll get 8 to 10 guys. Whoever agrees to do it, we probably wouldn't, you know, get George Carl or something. But all of a sudden, our list of guys we got and politicians and lawyers and everything was growing, that it kind of became people wanted to be a part of it. And to be able to get guys that aren't just sports people like Sherman Alexie, who's just a well-known award-winning writer, and to get Jeff Ament from Pearl Jam, who were basically people in our community who are just as big a Sonic fans as any, you know, standard sports nut or anybody you'd expect. Yeah. And that was kind of our thing. We wanted to the film to appeal to not just sports fans, but to anybody. We wanted anybody to leave the film being mad that the Sonics left and the way in which it was done. And, you know, the film is indicative of a lot of the problems in our country right now with the powers of big business and, you know, running over the small guy and everything. And so I think it was just a film, and what happened here resonated with a lot of people on a lot of levels, not just sports fans.
Yeah, no question. And I think you succeeded in your goal, because you do walk away from that pretty pretty pissed off that there's no team in Seattle anymore. Not to hold that against the folks in Oklahoma City. And that's another point that you seem to make a point of making during the documentary.
Yeah, I mean, we don't fault the fans. You know, we're now in a situation where if we get a team, it's probably going to be from another city losing their team. And, you know, we've had to just reconcile that over the years, is that how much that hurt us, but realize that that's just sort of the most likely way it's going to happen. And so we don't fault the fans of Oklahoma. We certainly fault their owners, and we don't root for their team. You know, we actually, our biggest fan, you know, our biggest fandom right now is just rooting against the Thunder, because we, no offense to Durant and Westbrook, we love those guys, but we'd like to see them lose forever and, or go to another city. You know, like, yeah. We don't want to see the guys who stole our team win. We're just looking forward to getting a team back and having, you know, this great new rivalry with them and their fans.
That'll make a great follow-up doc.
Yeah, definitely.
So one of the things that stuck out to me about the documentary, and really all these documentaries, all the sports documentaries in particular, the use of archival footage is really cool. And I know a lot of it is done out of necessity, but the way it's used is really engaging. I mean, it keeps the pace going. How much of that is editing?
Oh man, the editing is so huge. I mean, I of the filmmaking, you know, I love the shooting, I love all the producing and stuff like that. But the, you know, getting to edit a documentary and putting all the pieces together and figuring out how exactly to lay out the story in the way that people can understand is definitely, in my opinion, the most creative part of documentary filmmaking. And you know, we had so many different interviews. You know, we had 30 plus interviews with all these different people, and we had footage that we were recording live as it was happening, press conferences as it was happening. We had court documents that we had to incorporate because they didn't allow us to put bring cameras into the courtroom. And, you know, you have to, you know, all these things. I mean, that was all part of the whole reason we made the film, was to put all this information that was out there in all these different places into one place, into a logical thing, so someone could spend an hour or two watching it and really understand what happened, rather than picking at different articles and trying to read into what happened. We wanted to get all the information in one place. And, and that was kind of our goal through the editing process.
Yeah, exactly. And the things you're talking about, I mean, like I'm a writer for a magazine up here, and that's kind of my main gig. I don't know why they let me on the radio. They decided it was something that needed to be done. I'm not sure why. But yeah, like when I'm putting together a story, it's the same thing. It's that editing process. It's how is it all going to fit together? And I think of it kind of like a documentary. I think it's the same idea. How do you get all this information presented in a way that's consumable and still kind of makes people feel things?
Yeah, especially with a complicated, you know, issue like this, where you get into the, you know, arena subsidies, the politics and the voting and all the elements involved in these stadium leases and deals and the
intricacies of that. I mean, the fact that you can make stuff like zoning bylaws interesting in this documentary is a feat unto itself.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate the compliment.
So, when you're going to make this, I mean, what are the documentaries that you're thinking about that maybe like formed your style, or some of the sports documentaries, basketball specifically, that you really kind of gravitate towards?
Yeah, I mean, really when we were making this, there wasn't really a good model of like this kind of thing, other than like, honestly, like conspiracy theory type documentaries. You know, internet viral documentaries who are taking a controversial subject and just really hammering at it head on and trying to, you know, basically we always use the term InfoWar, you know?
Yeah.
We wanna, like, get all the information out there and inform the public. So it was kind of more like that style model rather than anything that was like a conventional sports doc, but it was really just we wanted, you know, fast-paced, and we wanted, you know, voiceover that could get all the information. You know, there's so much information to choose from. Our first cut of the movie was 4 hours, and, you know, we had to cut that down to 2 hours, and then we've cut it down to a TV hour now for the version that's playing on ESPN Classic and that aired on CNBC, and so... It's definitely a process to handle all that stuff. But I mean, I love all the standard sort of basketball documentaries like Hoop Dreams and that. But those weren't really necessarily relevant for this. This is actually less of a sports story and more of a political documentary in a lot of ways.
So you're taking a page out of like the Alex Jones book for this one.
Exactly. No, we've definitely seen a few of his films, and not to say that, you know, we had a countdown timer, for instance, on our website leading down to when the movie launched, and Alex Jones typically does that with these films.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, coming out January 30th. And so that actually helped drive a lot of traffic to us. So when we dropped the film, we had tens of thousands of views right off the bat, because we built up the hype in the way that successful internet videos have done over the years.
Well, I remember when it came out, and it was a hype thing. It was like, oh, hey, you know, buddy's calling you saying, you know, hey, it's out today.
Yeah, totally. And we built it up that way, and that was part of the fun of it. You know, we kind of bypassed your normal documentary or any film methods and released it for free, the whole movie for free online. You know, for us, it was about getting it out there as quickly as possible into as wide amount of audience, and we just made the decision to just get it out there for free, because our goal was to help try to get a team back and inform the public as to what happened here, so everyone else could be as pissed off as we were.
Oh, very cool. Like I said, succeeded in that for sure. Listen, I'm just looking at your IMDb page. You got a documentary coming out called The Kicker?
Yeah. We've been shooting The Kicker for almost 6 years now. It's the definitive look into the world of the NFL place kicker and the mind of the NFL place kicker. We've interviewed all the greatest kickers of all time. And, we have a rough cut. We're trying to work out, you know, all the final specifics. So we're actually going down to New Orleans to shoot Morton Anderson getting into the Ring of Honor down there on Monday night. This Monday night, we're going to be there filming. We're just kind of wrapping up the production on that and trying to find a distribution home. So, it's pretty exciting. That's another new sports doc we got coming down the pipeline. Have a lot of films in the pipeline though.
That sounds like a really cool one. Make sure people check that one out. Obviously at some point in the not so distant future, but in the future.
Kickermovie.com. You can check out a trailer.
Perfect. And Sonic Skate, you can find that where? iTunes?
Yeah, you can get it on YouTube. iTunes. You can, I believe you can watch it on Amazon Prime right now. You know, you can go to sonicskate.com. That has a link to just all the different ways that you can view the film and trailers and other information. So.
Perfect. All right, listen, Jason, really appreciate you taking the time, man. Best of luck.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
All right, cheers.
Okay, cheers. Where
do we go from here?
Hey, it's Kalo, and you're listening to Free Association.
Okay, welcome back to Free Association. Thanks to Jason for that. Sonic Skate is a tough, it's a tough watch if you're a Sonics fan. I mean, for me, I like the team. Like growing up, you know, I think when you're a little kid at that age, and I was a little kid at that age, you kind of either love the Jordan Bulls or you love the Sonics. They were like the other team.
Yeah.
And I love the Sonics, but I know you loved the Sonics.
Yeah, I think for me, the thing that I think the film accomplishes the most, and that's kind of almost lost in it all, because I think it is about more than just Seattle losing their team. It's about the state of the NBA and the way that they hijack cities into paying. And you're seeing this right now with the St. Louis Rams, where Stan Kroenke, a billionaire, is asking the city of St. Louis to fork over hundreds of millions of dollars to keep a franchise there that only he profits off of. So yeah, I think it's a great commentary just on the sad state. Or look what just happened with the Bucks. Again, one of the richest guys in America holding a city hostage by being like, hey, I know that this means something to you. I know you identify through this in your community. I know that you share memories here. It's about more than just watching a basketball game. And they leverage that into giving millionaires even more taxpayer dollars, which is truly insane to me. It's one of the worst things about pro sports, in my opinion.
Yeah, when I was in a university, my big like culminative paper, like my dissertation, whatever you want to call it, was about how taxpayers investing in stadiums and arenas is the worst possible thing for a city.
And they sell you on this whole idea that it's going to renovate the area and its businesses are going to boom and all this. And nothing has ever linked.
Ultimately, you always lose.
You lose. It's
so rare that you don't. But yeah, so that's what I was talking about with Jason, was the fact that you got these like David Stern and Clay Bennett in this movie are like A-class villains. Like,
yeah, they are.
Movie trope villains.
Oh, especially considering like, I think it's Aubrey McClendon is the other partial owner of the Thunder that was his business partner, is just like a vile human being, like a true low-class dude who funds a ton of money to fight gay marriage in the States, oil baron dudes. Just like, it's almost like you couldn't write it. It's basically, it reminds me a lot of the major leagues. Huh. You know the premise of the major league where they buy the team and they just want to move it and they want to make it as terrible as possible so they can get people to disassociate with it. And it's
dude, like, I really wish you were there for this interview just now, because when they made that movie, they were making Major League 4.
Yeah.
Before it became a documentary, they were making Major League 4 with the same plot, but instead of the Indians, it was the Sonics.
Yeah.
Seriously, he just said that.
I know. It's a heartbreaking. Like I said, it's honestly, it hurts me a lot, and it doesn't. It's something that I still struggle to like really listen to or go through again. It's a tough one for me. But
go check that out. You know, just before
watch Sonic 8.
Just before that.
Again, it also dismisses the myth that Seattle didn't want a basketball team.
Yeah.
That's always a terrible thing where people say, well, they should have fought harder to keep their team. Well, you're an idiot. You should watch this movie.
They did fight hard. And the irony of it all is, and again, we just touched on this, but the irony of it all is that when Seattle gets another team back,
they're going to blow the roof off that place.
No. They're going to be ripping it away from another city.
I'm hoping they don't. That's why I never wanted the Sacramento Kings. I've been on record. People know this. I never wanted the Kings to go to Seattle. I never wanted people to feel the same way I felt when the Sonics left. And the Kings had a great fan base for a lot of years. They deserve to have that team. I'm truly happy they kept it.
When Seattle gets a team, it will be from another city. It will be taking a team from another city.
See, I'm banking on expansion. I really am. I'd rather wait it out and get the expansion team. Unless it's somewhere like New Orleans. You never should have got that team. That should have been Oklahoma City's team.
I want to, you know, just before that interview started, though, you brought up a couple during the break, a couple more documentaries. And again, the list goes on forever, but you mentioned Through the Fire.
I haven't seen it yet, though. I've literally, looking up for this segment, I stumbled across it. And I have it downloaded on my computer, and I am really excited to watch it.
Ones like that, though, it's like I was talking about with Hoop Dreams. It's so cool to see that today. Like, it's a cooler experience, I think, for you to watch that today.
Knowing what Sebastian Telfair
exactly, became. Than had you watched that when it came out, and it was, like, essentially a Telfair
Although,
hype.
Although,
it
was a Telfair hype video. He was massive. Like, yeah, he was on the cover of Slam with LeBron.
Like, he was a high schooler who made a feature-length documentary.
I know, that's what I mean. It's just...
So to watch it now,
the director of the
more,
film probably should have realized that the 5'6" guy probably wouldn't be...
Another one that reminds me of Through the Fire is we were just talking about
Gunning that. For number one
Gunning
spot.
For the number one spot, the one from Adam Yauch, mm-hmm. Yauch, MCA, from Beastie Boys. That's a really cool one. It's Michael Beasley at his all-time cool bees self. Anyways,
I'd like to pitch you some documentaries.
Good, because
like
I there's one documentary. First of all, whenever I'm like pitching magazine stories and whatnot, in my mind, I'm always thinking, like, what would make the best documentary? Because I think that translates just in terms of what's the best story, you know? What pitch can I put in here that has all the storytelling elements of a great movie or a great doc? So there's one, for me, that is, above all, needs to be made. But I'm really interested to hear what you have as your pitch. The next great documentary.
So I have a couple. And I don't think that... I think you kind of hinted to me at what yours would be about, and I will say right away that I'd rather see yours.
Well, if anyone knows me, anyone who knows me who I've ever had anything close to this conversation with, they already know exactly what I'm going to say.
And we had a conversation about this a while back, and that's why I remember doing it over the phone a long time ago. For me, there's a couple. One is that, I read a piece by Wright Thompson on Michael Jordan's 50th birthday about where Michael Jordan is at with his life right now.
Shout out Brett Popplewell, Sportsnet Magazine, did this story. And it would make a great documentary if you're going where I think you're going
to
go.
And that's it. I would love to see a doc about elite athletes and Michael Jordan in particular, because Michael Jordan just fascinates me. Mm-hmm. Coming to grips with their mortality and losing the thing that made them most special. And seeing how different pro athletes that were at the top of the top, not just your average guy, not just... whoever, not even just like a guy who plugged in and made an all-star team here. Like, I don't want to see the Mitch Richmond documentary. Like, I want to see how Michael Jordan, how Kobe Bryant, how these type of guys who basketball was everything to them move on in later stages of their life. Because reading the Wright Thompson piece on Michael Jordan and about how he still doesn't sleep very much, how he still is a compulsive gambler, how he still can't let people leave if they best him at any type of game. How he still straps on the shoes every once in a while and plays a hornet and then can't move for days on end. That fascinates me, and I would love to see something on it. I'd love to hear Michael talk
about it. That's a killer one, and it would be, I think it would be sad as hell too.
It would be sad.
I think the cool way to do that would be to have a few different guys who are dealing with it in different ways.
That's why you'd have to have like Shaq, because he's clearly moved on.
Right, so
he's not holding
Shaq
on to ghosts.
He's just totally kind of at peace with the fact that his body failed him and was probably gearing up for it.
I mean, if he's hiding it, he's hiding it extremely well.
Exactly.
He's got more interest, though, right? Basketball wasn't always everything to Shaq. He had music. He had acting.
Right.
So these things were other passions of his, whereas MJ was just basketball.
But also, I would love to see that done with, you mentioned Kobe would be a great one for that, because you see a guy who just has to be having a really hard time dealing with the fact that he can't do what he once did. Mm-hmm. And then the third guy I think would be cool for that would be Vince Carter.
Yeah.
A guy who's dealing with it incredibly
as
well.
As he's going now.
You know, show that other side of the coin, that some people do figure out how to age and still play.
My other one I'd really love to see is about Dream Team 2.
I love that.
I think it would be really cool.
Who
if
was on
same,
Dream Team 2? I'm going to look it up. Keep talking.
So if the same, I know the general gist of many of the players.
Come on, it's more fun if I get to look.
Okay, sure, you can just look it up. But I think that it would be really awesome if the guys that made the original Dream Team documentary went out and did a follow-up with Dream Team 2, which got a little bit forgotten. I'm going to read them out to you because people want to. They had Derek Coleman, Joe Dumars, Kevin Johnson, Larry Johnson, Sean Kemp, Dan Marley, Reggie Miller, Alonzo Mourning, Shaq, Mark Price, Steve Smith, and Dominique Wilkins at the end of his career, who they brought basically on that team because he was hurt. He had an Achilles injury for Dream Team 1, and they brought him kind of as the elder statesman of this team. And they destroyed as well. Dream Team 2.
What a weird list of names.
I know. It's a very eclectic group of players. They absolutely dominated.
Yeah.
And all of them kind of were, like, other than Shaq and Reggie, I would say a lot of those guys kind of ended their careers with either question marks or a flaw or something that wasn't, Sean Kemp was a phenom.
They all strike me as all-stars, but not
transcendent
superstars
players.
Or not generational players.
Right.
Yeah. Like everybody on the Dream Team, except for Christian Leitner.
Boss, I mean, this was such a good team full of so many good players. And I remember being a kid and collecting cards of this Dream Team. And I loved them. And I still remember the jerseys they wore. And I remember following it, especially because Sean Kemp was there. And there was always a debate of who was better between Derek Coleman and Sean Kemp and Larry Johnson and Alonzo Mourning and really want to. And Shaq was a new thing. And he was already developing as the best player on that team. It was transcendent. So I would love to see kind of a follow-up story as to on Dream Team 2. And I think anytime you can get interviews with Reggie Miller and Mark Price and I don't know, there's some of these guys, Alonzo Mourning, it would be really
great. Would be wild would be to see the documentary for the, 2004, quote-unquote, Dream Team?
Yeah.
Is that the one that really bought him out? Was it 2004
the 2004
or 2000?
Team, the
2004.
2004, I think.
I got in front of me. 2004 was Melo, Carlos Boozer,
yeah.
Tim Duncan, AI, LeBron James, Richard Jefferson, Steph Marbury, Sean Marion, Lamar Odom, Emeka Okafor, Amari Stoudemire, and Dwayne Wade. And weren't they terrible?
I feel like it was the one before that.
Well, the one
where they lost
one,
to Argentina.
No, because the one before that was
they didn't win for
the one before that was Vince Carter, the dunk right, over Frederick Weiss. That was right. A good team.
Okay, yeah. So it must have been that team. They didn't finish in the. Didn't they finish third? They didn't make it to the gold medal game.
I don't know. It doesn't show results here. But basically, I'm down for a Dream Team documentary for every season.
They should just be following up Dream Team, Dream Team, Dream Team, and mostly just so, like you mentioned earlier, we can have that footage. Of these practices.
Because
another one, the most recent U.S. Olympic team, didn't you love watching the three-point contest between Steph
right.
and James Harden
yeah, yeah,
and Kyrie
yeah.
Irving? Those were awesome. Yeah. I was like, please, more of these.
And the practices they had one-on-one with Paul George, Durant,
right.
I
wanted as much.
Melo, I think it was.
And you know what? This one, the most recent one, would be very interesting too because you'd have the footage of the George injury and you'd be watching how the players reacted to it.
Ooh, right.
And then how Kevin Durant pulled out and how there was drama about it. That'd be an interesting one. It'd be Coach K's last one. You'd have that.
Well, I like those. Those are really good ones. I would definitely watch that. Okay, here's mine. One word. Two words. The.
You could just say.
Pistol.
Yeah, I'm very into it.
Pistol Pete Maravich. I don't know. There was two books that came out. You know, it's one of those weird things where when it comes out, like there's always multiples.
Yeah.
There was two Pistol Pete biographies that came out. 8 years ago, and they were really good, but kind of that's the only time where we've seen the Pistol Pete story been told and the legacy live on. I'm yet to see it in. I don't know if there's a movie.
There is a movie, but it's not a documentary. It's what do you call them? Biopics.
Yeah, it's a film.
Yeah, it's like the Man of Goat movie.
Right.
Except for it's not nearly as good as Rebounded.
See, Pistol could be a great. It would make a great film because there's a lot of scenes that need to be dramatized.
It did, but the thing about the Pistol movie, and I've seen it, and I really enjoyed it as a kid.
How were the basketball scenes?
Not spectacular, but it was more about a kid and his dream than about what happened with him.
See, that's BS.
That's what I mean. So that it's more about the story of Pistol being a small town kid who dribbled the basketball on the railroad tracks, going to school, who always had a basketball on him, and who told people about a dream that he had about making the NBA and being ridiculed, but then making it. It's not about Pistol, the adult.
The real story, setting it as a kid is fine.
You're right, as a kid.
The real story with Pistol Pete is here's a kid with more basketball talent than arguably anybody we've ever seen whose father made him hate the game of basketball. So here's a guy who we've never seen do things in this game before who loathed the game that he was playing. I'm sure part of him loved it, but the Pistol Pete story, real quick, I mean, he's a guy who... First of all, the scenes, you know, every great documentary has the talking heads say, you know, oh, and you should have seen him in his day. No one was doing what he was doing.
Still, you should go watch Pistol Pete YouTube clips
because
he still makes passes.
Imagine the documentary where a teammate says that and then they cut to the montage of Pistol Pete highlights, mm-hmm. which will blow your brains away today. Guys aren't doing that today in the NBA.
Yeah, he still has some passes that I still look at and I'm like, how
There's
does
passes
he
where he'd go on a 3-on-1 fast break. He's in the middle. He looks left. His arms
go left.
Yeah,
and he throws it left.
He passes left, but the ball somehow goes right.
I know, it's true. It's truly phenomenal.
Anyway, so Pistol Pete's dad, Press Maravich. Press Maravich was a coach at Clemson and a bunch of ACC schools, I believe. He basically molded Pistol Pete as a little kid into this thing. It's like, you remember the movie Shine?
Yeah.
Jeffrey Rush? So it's like that, like this like kid prodigy who was being molded and kind of like, but not necessarily by choice, you know? Like, I'm sure he grew up thinking, I really want to do this, but there was a point where he realized, my dad is making me do this. You know, like his dad would make him lie down in the back seat of a car, open the door, have him dribble on the street while he was driving and changing speeds. Which
I wish my dad.
In fairness, it's a great drill.
Yeah,
but it's also like child.
It's a little bit of a he got game vibe going on.
Yeah, but it's also real life. It's also like straight up abuse.
Mm-hmm. straight up abuse.
So you have Pistol Pete.
We should have called this podcast.
You have Pistol Pete kind of growing up and doing this crazy stuff, right? This crazy ability. He goes to college, and he at LSU averages JD averages 44 points per game as a lights out shooter. A deep shooter before they ever had a three-point line.
That's pretty much what I was like.
But so what would... So imagine adding a three-point line. I'm not even acknowledging that. So imagine adding a three-point line for a guy who's shooting threes, but they don't count. He's averaging like 50 points a game over three seasons.
Yeah.
So we're talking about one of the greatest players of all time. Then he goes to the NBA.
Never won, though, in the NBA.
He never won at college either.
Yeah.
So that's a... And that's an interesting side of this documentary is the whole like...
Some guys felt like Pistol Pete got way too much love because of the flash.
Which is a totally valid point. And exactly. I think that would be a conversation you'd have to have in this film is how much do you value showmanship and sheer ability versus adapting to a winning environment? I mean, he was on a winning team. He was on the Celtics late in his career, but he couldn't play then. You know, the sad shots of him on the bench and whatnot. But so he goes to the NBA. Like you said, he never wins. He had the Kobe broke his record for most points scored by a guard.
Yep.
I think he had 61 or 63.
That's another angle, though, of it, is that he was resented by some because they felt like there were other better black players that were not given nearly as much attention as Pistol was because he was white.
Totally valid. It's such an interesting conversation to have out of this. I didn't even think of that when I was thinking prepping for this show. So he's in the NBA. He retires. Now, after he retires, this is a guy who, again, resented the game of basketball because of the weird relationship with him and his dad. He gets out of the NBA. Now Pistol Pete
is dead.
Okay, you're fast-forwarding way too much.
Well, you said now.
Okay. You're with me on this story.
All right,
you're
with you.
We're out of the NBA. Pistol Pete is retired. He develops a drinking problem. He starts having some bizarre theories.
Didn't he use the alien stuff?
Like, he thinks aliens are landing on his house and things like that. He's seeing flying saucers. Pistol Pete is going a little bit crazy.
It's probably a reason why they haven't made this documentary.
Oh, this would be...
The estate of Pete Maravich is like, don't tell people about the aliens.
This would be enthralling. Pistol Pete was the only guy at the 50, you know, the NBA's 50 at 50.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was the only one who wasn't there. His son, his kids were there in his place.
Represented him.
Yeah. His kids who are basketball players too, by the way. So he gets out of basketball. He doesn't play anymore. You know, maybe he shoots a couple baskets with his kids when they're really young in the driveway, but he says, I'm done with basketball. You know, this, I didn't necessarily want this to be my life. It became my life. Now I have my own life, which is drinking and watching spaceships.
Oh, I was going to say drinking and watching basketball is like basically my life. So that was close. Me and Pistol were almost lockstep there.
The Pistol cleans himself up and he kind of becomes like a church goer. He becomes like a do-gooder. Now this is, you know, when he dies, I gotta look up the age. Whatever, he's older now. He's the pastor at his church, JD, this is the craziest part. The pastor of his church says to him, hey, we have a pickup game we do every week, and I know you don't play anymore, but it would really, really be amazing if you were to, you know, suit up and just hoist a couple of shots. Join our pickup game. We would be so thrilled if Pete Maravich can play with us. And he's saying, you know, this is the pastor, you know, I want to do right. He says, sure, you know what? I haven't played since I retired. I literally haven't played since I retired 20 years ago, whatever it is. But I'll play in your game. He steps onto the church basketball court. They tip up the ball and Pistol Pete collapses and dies right there on the spot. First time he's played basketball since he retired and he dies.
Maybe he should have played a couple more times.
before that.
Get that heart going. Maybe you should have got right. that heart rate going a few more times.
I'm glad you brought that up because they do the autopsy on Pistol Pete. I mean, this is crazy enough for a documentary.
It is.
They do the autopsy. It turns out that, now I'm going to get this wrong because I'm not a, are you sitting down? I'm not a scientist. But so they check his heart. Let's say your heart has like three valves going into it. Just let's pretend that's how it works. He only had one. You know, so doctors said he shouldn't have lived past the age of 10, let alone be this once in a multi-lifetime basketball talent. That's the story of Pistol Pete. It's just an amazing story that's never really
now no one
been
has
told.
To see the movie because you just did it.
No, but you can.
You just did the audiobook.
No, I just
the,
gave you the basic Cole's notes of these are the different notes we're going to hit in this documentary.
Yeah. Listen, you don't have to sell me. Like I said, I saw the biopic when
I'm
I was
just kind of shocked.
I
hope maybe one of my bosses are listening at Sportsnet. I'm just shocked that it hasn't been done yet. It's such a no-brainer. I know the 30 for 30 would have been the great vehicle for it, mm-hmm. but I think it's just before their timeline.
Now that Bill Simmons is gone from ESPN, those 30 for 30s just don't have the same juice.
No, but also like 30 for 30, like they look 30 years back. That's the function of it. So right. I think Pistol Pete's era doesn't cross over to that. You know, it doesn't work. But yeah, that's just waiting to be made. I feel like I rambled a lot there, but it was worth it.
I want to see it. You know what okay, else I want to see?
I'll make it. I'll make the home video version.
I want to see Emil Delic.
I'll do like Sonic Skate. I'll release it
on the
Kamikaze,
web.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it's on the internet and you can win a Webby. I want to, speaking of Webbies and seeing if things I want to do, I want to hear the best of our show from the last calendar.
Oh, yes. Our talented producer put together a best of reel, I'm told, which I'm never going to listen to because I can't imagine what the best of this show sounds like.
I can. I can only imagine. It's just going to be a lot of me.
Can we just list the guests we've had because, they're the
been
best
a good
part.
Year.
They're the best part as far
it's
as
been
I'm
a great saying. Year guest wise. We had Masai Ujiri a couple of times. We've had Ron Artest or Meta World Peace as we called him, even though his son was like, "Yeah, call him Ron." And we were there like Meta. He was probably like, "Yeah, you guys actually do that, eh? That's cool."
Wait, when did that happen?
His son said, "I call him Ron like a week ago." To TMZ. They were like, "Well, Meta." He's like, "Yeah, his name's not Meta. I call him Ron." Like, oh, well, aren't we foolish?
Well, everyone I dealt with booking that interview called him
it's called Meta. All right.
Anyways, yeah, so it's been a good year. We got some best of up ahead. Remember, you can always catch us on iTunes, on sportsnet.ca, because next year is going to be even better, especially you think about the All-Star
Jalen
weekend
Rose,
coming up.
Jalen Rose, Isaiah Thomas, Charles Oakley, all these guys have been on the show. It's been a really fun time.
So here you go, the best of Free Association. Enjoy.
More
happy
to come
holiday.
In 2016.
Hey, this is Matt Bonner, the Red Rocket, and you're listening to Free Association.
All right, welcome to Free Association. Right now, it is time to give the people what they want, and that is the name of the new book from our next guest, Gotta Give the People What They Want, written by 13-year NBA vet, fellow podcaster, and now author, Jalen Rose. Jalen, what's going on, man?
Gotta give the people what they need. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Hey, man, I read the book. It was excellent. We got the advanced copy. It was really awesome. I think I tore through it in about 3 days. Like, really entertaining read. I don't think Bill Simmons over-exaggerated when he talked about your life. It was a fascinating read. So, first of all, congratulations, man. It was really great.
Thank you. I appreciate the support. I appreciate the feedback that I've gotten from the book. People seem to really appreciate the honesty, me being uncut and unfiltered. That's what I wanted to do. I looked at writing the book at this point in my life almost like a rebirth. Whatever happened before that day, I'm just going to exhale and I'm going to let it out. You think I'm proud to tell the world I peed in the bed until I was in fourth grade? I put all my business in the street.
That's the way to go. Listen,
there were some flattering stories in there, too. There were some good ones. It wasn't all just pee bed and rock teeth. There was more than that.
Listen, Jalen, man. Yeah, I mean, like, there's so many stories to go through, and that's obviously another reason to write a book like this is because, I mean, nobody's got stories like you in the NBA. I mean, after all those years. Here in Toronto, obviously, there's some really famous stories we all know about. But, I mean, I got to say, for me, you own my favorite quote in Raptors history, and that would be after they traded Vince Carter and the media is telling you about it in the scrum, and you go, oh, who'd we get, Richard Jefferson?
Not quite.
I mean, listen, yeah,
not
quite.
You got to play with the Williams brothers, though. Like, that was pretty close.
But see, here's the thing about that. And by the way, I loved my time in Toronto.
Yeah.
You know, being a Detroit native and being exposed to the culture, I still have many friends in the T-Dot to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I need to sneak back over there for Caravana or whatnot, but that's another subject for another day.
Yeah.
But listen, I mean, when you talk about your time in Toronto, I mean, it's you use the term all the time, classic test your professionalism material. And, I mean, there's just, like, time after time, I can think of, like, a dozen examples off the top of my head, that Richard Jefferson quote kind of illustrating one of them. I mean, when you look back on your time here, great on one hand, but it must have been frustrating on another.
You know, the trials and tribulations of an NBA veteran. And I actually said not only should we have gotten Richard Jefferson, we should have gotten Jason Kidd,
mm-hmm.
especially at a time when the team knew that Alonzo Mourning was going to refuse to play for us.
Yeah, exactly.
It just... So that was frustrating, and again, like I said, I love the fans, and I had a great time there. But one, I think the most frustrating part was the time I felt like we had a really good team, and I broke my hand in the Golden State game.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were like a 500 team. I felt like we were going to make the playoffs, and that was the Kevin O'Neal season, so that was disappointing. But again, being in Toronto and seeing how the team has grown, I mean, the changes that they've made. It started with Tim Leiweke,
yeah.
and then he hires Masai Ujiri, a GM. And before you know it, Casey becomes the guy on the sideline. And that always plays into the dominoes of what you see on the court. They've improved the basketball team immensely, a consistent playoff-caliber team. Now it's up to them to see if they can become a contending team.
One of the quotes I love the most from your book, and I think it's even on the jacket, which is just talking about one of the things you wanted to do was start conversations, and the other was start arguments. And just we want to move on from the old Raps days and get your thoughts on some other stuff and some other stories from the book. But I thought your quick write-up on Vince Carter, where you mentioned about Vince being one, this is where one argument would stem, was that he was the second most talented player that you ever played with after C-Web. And two is that you kind of felt that he did raw a little bit. And last season, there was a lot of, like, Vince got the standing ovation here in Toronto, and there seemed to be a little bit of amends between him and the fan base, but a lot of people still, you know, resent Vince and are still upset with Vince. There was, of course, that story that he gave the Sonics the final play of the game. So you think, like, ultimately, like, looking back on Vince's time here, that, like, he was the guy that ended up with the raw end of the deal?
He did, because the individual, and for him, he's become a veteran. He's the all-time great Raptor in team history.
Mm-hmm.
You only have one name. As an organization, the faces that were leaking information and were whispering about your character and things away from basketball, most, if not all, of those faces are no longer there.
Yeah.
That's why.
Isn't it?
In longevity. Like, players
okay.
get to
okay.
play longer, so your numbers get inflated. Like, so when you put Anton Jameson's numbers up, his 2010 seasons, and how many rebounds and points he has total, as well as Vince Carter, like, those numbers become comparable to players that are in. Like, Vince Carter's all-star games, and I love Reggie Miller and Chris Mullin, my teammates in Indiana. I think he's probably have as many all-star appearances as those two guys combined.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he had like a 10-year streak going on.
Yeah, so when you take that in consideration, I do think he's going to be in, maybe not first ballot like Allen Iverson will be, but Vince Carter definitely will be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and a lot of guys have brought it up, but one of the cool things about Vince is I don't know if there's a guy that went from being a superstar that remodeled his game quite the way that he did to become just a refined role player and that's been able to stretch that career out and do so many different things. The one thing, though, to put to bed with Vince is that you said you were a guy that was on the inside, and you do feel like he was done poorly, but you never looked at Vince once in a while with the injuries and questioned them yourself or questioned, hey, like, maybe he's milking this a little bit too much. Maybe he's taking a little bit more time off than we think.
But that's hard to say.
Because I know this. There's a difference between being hurt and injured. When you're injured, you can't go.
Right.
Guys are not trying to get surgeries and be on the training table. That's the equivalent of you showing up at your job late. That's the equivalent of you having to go to HR because you've been undisciplined. Those become dings on your resume, and they affect your bottom line come negotiating time. So players want to be out there and want to be eligible when the game happens. But some players are just more injury-prone than others. It's how it works. And that's a disappointing thing for me right now, what I'm seeing in the game. is that I appreciate, and it started with Coach Pop, five-time champion, the best coach in the league. He has an older basketball team that still found ways to win championships and be in first place. So because of that, I can rest players because we're going for it all, even if they're healthy during the season. I can limit their minutes.
Right.
But as it relates to other players that aren't and teams that aren't as accomplished, it really irritates me because there's no guarantee that you get a 10 to 15 year free run of health, you know, and guys that played, you know, LeBron James has already played more minutes than Magic Johnson and Larry Bird in his young career. Larry Bird, you saw him at the end of his career. He gave it all. He ended up laying on his stomach when he came out of the game, laying on his back when he came out of the game.
That's right.
Like, but now since you're able to extend players' careers, you see a guy like Vince, who came along in both eras, able to reinvent himself, knock down an open three-point shot, and have an 18, 19, 20-year opportunity for a career because of the advances in technology, but also somewhat the coddling of professional athletes.
Love and happiness. But wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone.
Hey, this is Max from the Arcel, and you're listening to Free Association. Yeah.
Talking about how she can make it right, yeah.
The one, the only, Sim Goulart joining me down the line, Raptors 905 center. Sim, I want to start with your days playing AAU ball with the likes of Anthony Bennett, with the likes of Tyler Ennis. There has to be one story on the road where you're thinking, that's the time I'll remember with my buddies.
I mean, honestly, the stories, I don't really recall any of them, but I mean, we did have a lot of good memories just traveling together and all living together, and I remember probably one of the memories that always stick in my mind would be when we went to Orlando for like AU Nationals, and I guess there's like a flea market right next to the hotel, and then guys just decided one day to just everybody get team tattoos and stuff, and they all just went there and went crazy with the tattoo shop, and that's where I guess the AB got his first tattoo, and a bunch of the guys just got those. I mean, that was a pretty fun tournament. I really enjoyed it. I mean, that was just a good team experience we had growing up together. And,
These were real tattoos?
Yeah, real ones.
Wow. If I went on a trip when I was a kid and I would have come back and had tattoos, my parents would have murdered me. I'd be dead. We wouldn't be talking right now. I'd be murdered. That would be the situation right now.
I mean, everybody wasn't really that young. I mean, I guess. Probably 17 or 18. I mean, it was just a...
Still, you have a guardian. You have parents. Like, you're still living at home. I know you're not like a... It's not like you're 13, but I'm telling you, if I came home 17 years old... Come back from a trip, tattoos. I'm in trouble. Let's just put it down.
I mean, I think everyone's parents were okay with it. I mean, they knew that they want the kids that got them already wanted them. So I mean, I guess they're really okay with it. They weren't really mad about it or anything.
Hi, DeMar DeRozan, Toronto Raptors, and you're listening to Free Association. When there's no one else around, I'm gonna take you, girl, and hold you,
and do all the things I told you in the midnight hour. Welcome to Free Association. Thanks for tuning in. Down the line, one of our favorites, Tracy Murray, NBA champion, 50-point scorer, and now the LA Lakers shooting coach, a guy who's working with some good young talent down there. Tracy, how you doing, buddy?
Good. Thank you for having me on, guys.
A lot's been made about Kobe this season. He's made a lot of headlines in terms of, you know, his difficulty with a shot. And, you know, the other night he played 35, 36 minutes and starting to weigh in the little body a bit. But the thing I'm kind of curious to hear from you when it comes to him is how he is around the team and kind of how he is with the young guys as well. Because kind of throughout his career, he's at least had the rap of being a guy that isn't going to be a guy that's going to maybe take a ton of time. You remember in the summer, the video of the guys that all came in there, Lou and Roy and Brandon, the video of, has Kobe reached out to you guys and you're all quiet. But I'm kind of curious to hear, you know, what's Kobe like on a day-to-day basis right now, especially when it comes to, you know, being with the young guys, because he has to know that this is a franchise in transition and that it's looking now more to building past himself.
Well, Kobe has been extremely patient with the young guys. He's been more of a mentor, big brother type of deal. Kobe's not the type that's going to be buddy, call you, you know. Kobe's not that type of guy. But at the same time, Kobe loves to win. He cares about winning. He loves the Laker organization. He cares where the organization is going. So he's been really patient. He's been good. He's been a mentor. He's even grabbed the clipboard when the coaches are in the huddle about before they come in during the timeout. He's even grabbed the board a couple of times and said, "Hey, guys, this is where you're supposed to be right here. And when I do this, this is how you have to react." So when you have him, you know, kind of being a coach on the floor and helping the coaching staff out with because he has an extremely high basketball IQ. So when he's able to help out and when he's able to be patient with the guys, you know, they're able to grow. And I think he's doing an excellent job of that. And you know, as far as his shot, I rebound and pass to him a lot.
Okay.
And, you know, I just made one suggestion the other day, and then you saw him start hitting shots recently from the perimeter.
Oh.
And it was basically because Kobe, he's always been able to shoot the ball. So one thing I'm never going to do is take credit for Kobe Bryant's shot. Never.
I think you kind of did. Know? That's what we're going to write down. That's the headline of this interview.
No, never.
Tracy
never
Murray, I am the man behind Kobe.
The Kobe
you got
whisper.
It?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
That right there is a negative.
Okay.
He's played 20 years, and he's one of the best ever played the game for a reason. But just one simple thing was just get the ball up in the air and shoot a little bit higher, a little bit more arch. And he's been dropping shots recently, and, you know, because father time always wins with athletics.
But also, I mean,
you know, the lower you jump, you have to get more arch in your shot.
Well, exactly. I was going to say, like, the Achilles thing has to affect him in some way, too, and it's probably in, you know, the lift off the ground. That's probably the most immediate way.
Well, you look at the Achilles, the knee, and people don't realize how important your shoulders are in your shot, but your shoulder too. So, I mean, he's had surgeries on all three. So, you know, it takes a little bit of time. It takes, you know, he's a hard worker. He's putting forth the effort. He's putting in the time, and he's gonna work. He's a true professional. So, you know, it was just something small. He just realized that hey, I'm still able to free up. I'm still able to get my shot off. Now I need to get it up in the air and give it a chance. That's basically what it was.
Man, I still play once a week, and when you guys are in Toronto, I gotta get a session in here. I gotta get like just 15 minutes, please. But, I couldn't afford you.
Hi, this is Chuck Swirsky, voice of the Chicago Bulls. You're listening to Free Association. Onions, baby, onions.
All right, you're listening to Free Association, and joining us down the line, the one, the only, Meta World Peace, who just celebrated his 36th birthday. So first of all, happy belated birthday, Meta.
I appreciate it. I'm excited. I feel great. I'm older, and I feel great.
Who's the best MC in the NBA, not including yourself?
Lou Williams.
Oh.
That was my vote, by the way, Meta. I'm just going on record there. Okay.
Lou's amazing.
Yeah, he's awesome. BLT or club sandwich?
BLT.
What's your favorite thing you can only get in Canada when you come up here and visit?
I love Canada. I love Canada.
So do we.
I mean, everything. I love Canada. One of my favorite places.
You know what? We'll take that. Yeah. Okay, when's the last time you cried at a movie?
Oh, wow. I cry every movie. Like, anything. I even cry in tennis matches. Like, when Serena plays, I just can't. When I watch anything emotional, like, I can't hold back.
Do you blame Drake for Serena missing out on the Grand Slam?
Absolutely. Oh, man. I'm so... That relationship could have waited.
Oh, man.
Hey, in a zombie apocalypse, who's the last guy in the NBA left standing?
metal world.
Yeah.
Good answer.
I think that's a solid answer. Okay, if you were a wrestler, what would your entrance music be?
Well, I would wrestle, my entrance music would be maybe a Drake song.
Okay.
Interesting.
A little bit. I'm going to lull my opponent to sleep. Hotline Bling.
I like that.
A last one for me. Do you remember the best thing a fan ever yelled at you?
The best thing a fan ever yelled at me was, "You saved me from being an arsonist."
Oh, wow. All right.
That happened actually. That was crazy.
Wow.
That is crazy.
Do you collect anything?
I don't collect anything. I'm not a big fan of having too much things because I move a lot. Mm-hmm. And I hate when I have to pack.
Free Association. Please be joined down the line by NBA legend.
Legend with a capital L.
Oh, are you kidding? Isaiah Thomas. Again, Isaiah, how are you today?
Zeke, how you doing?
I am great. How are you guys doing?
Couldn't be more thrilled for this, man. Really appreciate you coming on the show. Let's get right to today's NBA. I mean, right now it's a point guards league. There's no question about that. You know, the rules favor point guards. The style of play favors point guard play. I mean, it must kill you that you're not still playing right now. I mean, you'd be dominating, wouldn't you?
I would definitely have a good time. The rules, you're absolutely right. The rules definitely favor the point guard. It favors the perimeter players. You know, there's no hand checking. So consequently, you know, the point guard, you know, has dribble moves now in front of him. If you look years back, when there was hand checking, and you can also use the arm bar, what they call it.
That's right.
You know, most of your ball handling had to be done on the side of you. Today, most of the ball handling is done in front of the defender. And I think right now this is probably the worst point guard defensive era that I've ever seen. I haven't seen perimeter defensive play so poorly. Now, I know the rules have a lot to do with that, but containing your man and keeping your man in front of you, that's one of the first lines of defense. And right now, I don't see a lot of great defenders at the point guard position.
That's saying you had a pretty good career. I think you were pretty fine in terms of era that you played in. You were okay.
But, you know, but it's interesting.
I did all right. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, just all right. But, you know, I think it's really interesting what you're saying, because I assume, you know, a lot of that has to come down to kind of coaching and the way these kids are kind of coming up through the game. You know, I heard you speak, I forget where it was, but I heard you say, you know, about the lack of creativity amongst guards or just players in general. You know, everyone seems to be kind of built from the same mold. And when you talk about guys, you know, dribbling in front of them, you know, that comes to mind, the kind of same weak defense across the board, that comes to mind. I mean, is this something that's starting really early on for these guys, or is that something that's being kind of beat into them once they get to the NBA?
I think it's starting early on. You know, when we were taught the game was taught as an art form, as a way of expressing creativity. And you wanted to be original in your play, even mm-hmm. though you wanted to do things like someone else was doing, but you wanted to have an original style. You know, right now with analytics and the sharing of information, and everyone has access to the same information, mm-hmm. When everyone has access to the same information, it normalizes everything. Everyone starts to act, do, and think the same. So consequently, we don't see a lot of originality anymore in the NBA, and we don't see that that creativeness. Every time I went out on the floor, I tried to paint a masterpiece. And if I did a move the day before, I wanted to come back and try something different. I always wanted to be a creator and always wanted to be original out on the floor. And I don't see much originality nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like things like signature moves, you know, you think of everyone kind of had their own go-to move that they would craft themselves, you know, alone on the court and then bring it to a five-on-five game or a pickup game or whatever it is. You just don't see that anymore.
Like, I don't know. That one guy on YouTube seems to be doing a pretty good job of taking everybody's signature moves and putting it. What's that guy's name?
I forget. Yeah, the guy's doing
the
impressions.
He's got to do one of you, Isaiah.
But even he's doing like little mannerisms. I mean, Isaiah's talking about like total kind of skill sets and your whole your move set and how it's unique to each guy.
I'm also talking about being original with it, coming up with something new. So I think what made the 80s so golden was that you had a lot of originals coming to the league. No one had really played the game like Larry Bird came in playing it.
Yeah.
Dr. J was an original. When you looked at Magic Johnson, 6'9", as a point guard, doing the things that he was doing at 6'9", he was an original. The things that I was doing at the point guard position, it wasn't coming down playing like, the traditional point guards. It was playing like the point guards play today. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of originality that took place in the 80s. And even when you got into the 90s, Jordan, the things that he brought to the game, even though they were similar to Dr. J and Julius Erving
and David Thompson as well.
He added the jump shot, which made him different, which made him another original. So when you look at today's game, the only original player that I see doesn't play like anyone that I've seen play before, you know, is Kevin Durant. He plays a game like I've never seen anyone at his size play. Do the things that he does. LeBron James arguably is the best player in the NBA, but he has a little magic. He has a little Oscar. He has a little of everyone. Durant has he just, I don't know what he has, but he has it when he's on.